Pharaoh wanted Moses to die, not because he had targeted Moses in particular, but because the one that did not know Joseph, who had gone into power in Exodus 1, was concerned that the Israelites were increasing in number and could pose a threat if that wasn't curbed. And so the male Hebrew babies were to be thrown into the Nile, and Moses' parents were courageous. A couple weeks ago, the last time we were in Hebrews 11, was in verse 23, when we saw Moses' parents are the example of faith there, because they were courageous in the face of an edict from their king. It says they were not afraid of the king's edict. To go against the king would certainly mean their death or some sort of terrible treatment. Certainly the death of the child if it was located. This, therefore, was a very courageous act that they did in the midst of great risk. But they believed that God's favor was on their child. And it shows us in verses 24 and following, as the writer is going to highlight some stories from Moses' life, that God's favor was indeed on this child. And a great thing was going to happen starting with his growing up and the event in Exodus 2. It tells us here that by faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And in order to understand what the writer is doing, there's not an actual verse that he's quoting from here in terms of a passage, but he's alluding to a particular story. And I think the language likely is coming from Exodus 2. I think we'll see how the allusions are there when we listen to these words. In Exodus 2, Moses had been born in the opening verses, preserved by a basket on the river, and then it says that Pharaoh's daughter finds the child, the baby is crying, she says, in verse 6, she opened it, saw the child, behold, the baby was crying, she took pity on him. In verse 7, his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child? Pharaoh's daughter said, go. The girl went and called the child's mother. So as Moses' mother no doubt believed I would never see my child again, now she's reunited with the child, sanctioned by Pharaoh's daughter herself. And Pharaoh's daughter says, take the child and nurse him for me. I'll give you your wages. So now she's going to be paid to nurse her own child. She would have done that anyway. Now she's going to be compensated for it. And so the woman took the child and nursed him. And then when the child grew up, this is our passage tonight, Exodus 2:10. When the child grew up, that's what the language of Hebrews 11:24 opens with. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. So there's the idea. The child has grown up, and he's considered Pharaoh's daughter at this point. Pharaoh's daughter's son. I'll get it right. And he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, I drew him out of the water. So it sounds like the word to be drawn up in Hebrew, which is why Moses has his name, Moses. But here's the passage I think the writer has in mind in Hebrews 11. What happens next in the story? Exodus 2:11 says, one day, when Moses had grown up, so there's that language again, when he had grown up, what did he do? He went out to his people and he looked on their burdens. This probably picks up the idea that there was mistreatment of the people of God. There was suffering of the people of God. Moses went out to his people, looked on their burdens, and here's what he saw. An Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Now he's faced with a choice here. Because here are two peoples represented in the fight. The Egyptians and the Hebrews. And he knows that this is one of his people that's being beaten. In verse 12, he looked this way and that. Seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And we're to take that to mean he murdered him. This was a very important story in Jewish tradition. In fact, Stephen quotes from this in Acts 7 when he's giving a grand speech before his martyrdom. Listen to Acts 7, verse 20. Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight, and he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. He was mighty in his words and deeds. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. So while Exodus 2 doesn't tell us an age, and while Hebrews 11 doesn't tell us an age, it does tell us when Moses had grown up, and Stephen says he was about 40. Now maybe you would consider people having grown up prior to then, but 40 is the age in this case. He visited his brothers, the children of Israel. Listen to Acts 7:24. Seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. Now, Hebrews 11, I think, is alluding to this story. This isn't original with me. The New Testament scholars who argue for this interpretation, I think, are right. The writer is aware of this tradition in Exodus 2, the scripture, and he's interpreting it for us. He's summarizing it in a way, Hebrews 11:24, when Moses had grown up, about the age of 40, he did not want to be considered as Pharaoh's daughter's son anymore. This was not going to be his identity. And faced with this choice where there's a fight, Moses is going to identify with either the victim being oppressed, the Hebrew, or he's going to identify with the Egyptian who is the aggressor. The writer seems to portray Moses as arriving at a fork in the road, and his decision was very important. And he believed that this was his people being victimized and mistreated. It says in Hebrews 11:24, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, he never says in Exodus, I don't want to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But I think this is a way of illustrating the very common statement that actions speak louder than words. So, though Moses didn't say, I don't want to be called Pharaoh's daughter's son anymore, that is what he's saying by his actions. By the defense of the Hebrew, avenging him against the Egyptian and burying the Egyptian in the sand after he had killed him, that was a way of saying, I am not to be affiliated with the aggressor, with those who are abusing and mistreating the people of God. Rather, in verse 25, this is incredible, isn't it? He is choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God. He knows that if he aligns himself with the Hebrews, this does not guarantee things will go well for him necessarily physically. I mean, he could be under great risk and great duress. But he believes in the promise. After all, a promise has been given to the Hebrews that they had maintained even through that day. That the God was going to take them to a promised land. This is what Abraham believed, and Isaac believed, and Jacob believed, and Joseph believed. Hebrews 11 calls their faith confidence in a reward, or what was coming, or the things that were yet to come. Moses seemed to have the same idea. At the end of verse 26, it says, he was looking to the reward. So Moses is somehow, in his growing up, even in the court of Egyptians, around the Hebrews, has discovered this hope. Not only his identity as being a Hebrew, but this reward and what they were hoping would come to pass. What's Moses doing? He's doing a calculation. Moses is calculating that it's the God of Israel that's behind these Israelites. And while they are temporarily oppressed, God is going to make good on his promise. So what's Moses going to do? He's not going to side with the ones who have sided against God. That's not going to be wise. Moses now refuses to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God. He would rather suffer with the people of God than all things go well with him and he not be with the people of God. And that's an incredible fork in the road, isn't it? I would rather suffer with the people of God because they will prevail. The people of God will triumph because their God is all-powerful and will keep his promises. I think he's just taking the long view. I don't think he's saying, oh, tomorrow or the next week things will definitely be better for me. I mean, he's 40 years old and these people have been oppressed now all of these decades because 40 years earlier, the order had been to throw these Hebrew babies in the Nile. So it has been year after year, decade after decade, and Moses still says, I would rather be with the suffering people of God than with Pharaoh, rather than siding with him. Verse 25 says, he would rather be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. The writer is very deliberate there to show what Moses is missing out on. What's Moses missing out on? Well, to align himself with the Egyptians against the people of God, he would be aligning himself with what was sinful. And in terms of the power and ability and indulgences of that day in that court that Moses would have had full access to, being part of that family, it was all fleeting. Moses is just making a realistic evaluation from God's perspective. All of these things might look very appealing to the worldly eye. Moses says, they're not going to last. They're fleeting. He seems, in contrast to that, siding with the people of God, believing that they will last. These pleasures of sin that are belonging with Pharaoh's family and court and rule is temporary. So why would he align himself with that? Jim Elliot said in a journal, this was the gentleman who was martyred by the Alka Indians, he said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." That's a great statement. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Moses had before him the fleeting pleasures of sin, but nobody can keep them. They're fleeting by definition, and they're sin. They're dishonoring to God. So Moses said, "I would rather suffer with the people of God." He had the right evaluation because this was God's perspective on sin and suffering as a result of your iniquity, something that you should not pursue. He would rather, if he's going to suffer, do it because he's honoring God and part of God's people. In verse 25 here, the fleeting pleasures remind us that aligning ourselves against God does involve desire to an extent. It involves desire in both cases. Moses desiring something and being tempted by the fleeting pleasures of sin to desire something. Because to desire what is pleasurable. What was Moses looking toward at the end of verse 26? Looking toward a reward. See, it's not a matter of you desiring or not desiring. It's a matter of what you want more. That's what's put before Moses. And rather than looking at the pleasures of sin, Moses deems them fleeting and dishonoring to God. What does Moses want more? More than the pleasures of sin, he wants the pleasures of God. And knowing God and the reward of God for his people. Moses desires that far more. He believes that is more valuable. I think that in the end, friends, is one of the most basic and simple ways to put the battle of our the spirit against the flesh in terms of desire. The spirit desires what's contrary to the flesh, and the flesh what's contrary to the spirit in Galatians 5. And in the book Future Grace, John Piper argues that in the end, it's a battle of pleasure. Sin calls out to you with its pleasure. And what we fail to realize is that holiness and righteousness are also calling to us with desire and pleasure that awaits. And yet not only so, the pleasure and the desire that is true and will last. In contrast to the delusion of sin, which does call us and calls us to desire and lays before us pleasures, but which are bankrupt and delusional and do not last. It's a battle of desire and a battle of pleasure. In verse 26, here's the motive behind Moses' choice. I neglected to say at the beginning, the way I think the passage is broken down is Moses' decision in verses 24 and 5. He basically refuses to be part of the Pharaoh's court and rather the people of God and rather than enjoying the pleasures of sin. But why? In verse 26, I've been saying it, and now we get the actual verse for it, is because he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Moses had a long view. And I think it's difficult with our momentary trials and our daily difficulties that we may have for us to take a long view. Our reality presses in on us and presses our perspective into the here and now. And we just react against that. And the Bible is constantly wanting to open our minds to what's always going on around us and always unfolding before us and after us. The story that God is telling about His people and which will reach a consummation of reward. Moses believed this. The treasures of Egypt were legendary. What Egypt was to possess in terms of its wealth and its riches, and its grains, and its food, and its concubines. The treasures of Egypt were legendary. Moses looked at that, and he says, "That's nothing compared to what God has. That's not as good as what God has." He believed what God had was better. And I think that one of the reasons people may not be interested in obeying Christ and following Christ and seeking to live a righteous and holy life before Him is because they don't believe that's better. They believe sin is better. They believe what it delivers is better. They believe what it holds out for them will come to pass no matter how many times it has failed them. They fail to believe the truth of the Scriptures, that sin will always be what it is, a closed system of delusional bankruptcy, spiritually and emotionally. And yet what God has for us, He just lays out a feast. C.S. Lewis said in Mere Christianity that sometimes we're like young children who are at a beach playing with mud pies because we just can't imagine what it's really like to have a holiday at the sea that is offered to us. And Lewis said, arguing from desire for the existence of God, that if I have a desire for hunger, it's because a certain thing has been created like food. And if I have a desire for thirst, it's because a thing has been created to quench that thirst. And he said, if I have protected myself a longing for things that are beyond this world, that may indicate from my desire, it's because I was made for another world. It's because I was made, just following my own desire for something more, that something out there exists that will quench it. And he believed that the gospel revealed in Christ was that answer. And that all these stories would be pointing to him. And that if Lewis, I think Lewis is right. I think he makes an argument from desire that should be heard as we examine in ourselves with the work of the gospel, that indeed there is a quenching, satisfying aspect to knowing Christ. Not because we are perfect in satisfaction, but because we seek now and always, trying to be satisfied in Him. It's just like Jesus says that blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. There is a promise that Jesus says we will be satisfied. Well, Moses, I think, has these attitudes, maybe not expressed in the ways that I've just described it, but at least in seed form, where he believes in God's promises. One aspect that I want to focus on lastly is that phrase, the reproach of Christ. Maybe you would have expected the writer to say, Moses considered the reproach of the people of God to be greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. And if you look at the word Christ there, it seems really odd that Moses would consider something like the reproach of Christ to be greater wealth because he was in Exodus. And Jesus doesn't come until after Malachi, right? So this seems a bit odd to use that language. So I think the writer, though, is being anachronistic on purpose. I think he's showing that there's a unity to the people of God, and that when the people of God are believing in the promises of God and are trusting in this God, what promises did this God ultimately bring to pass through this family? He brought Christ. So it's as if all that they went through was bearing witness to God's promise in Christ. It's as if all of the suffering was in this long line of those who are pointing forward and pointing forward to the one in Hebrews 12 who would, for the joy set before him, endure the cross. It's as if Moses bore the reproach of Christ, even though he didn't even know his name. It's as if Moses, with his forward-thinking faith and the hope of God's reward, was in line with the people of God who, in so suffering the way they did, were in that line of promise until that Redeemer came. And I think this is the writer's way of linking Moses to that grander story. Why would this be helpful for the people of God in the writer of Hebrews' day? Well, these three verses would be tremendously encouraging because Rome was in power, and Rome was very intimidating. And when this letter was written, just years earlier, Christians had begun to be greatly persecuted by an order of Nero as they were being blamed for a particular fire in Rome, and many atrocious things were happening to them. And in future Roman emperors, there would be suffering that Christians endured. What's this writer saying? This writer's saying, you're always going to have some people who may seem like another Pharaoh. That siding with them and their will and their agenda might make you safe temporarily. But what the writer is wanting for his readers in the first century is the same thing that should be true for us. It's always better to suffer with the people of God than to align yourself against the people of God. And the reason it's always better to suffer with the people of God is because the people of God are the ones who will prevail in the end because of God's promise and faithfulness and reward that's going to come. It's not as if finally God will meet his match and that one day there will be some sort of formidable ruler or dictator or president or leader or governor who's going to finally derail God's promise to bring about the reward. If we truly believe that God's going to bring about what He's promised, then we should be like Moses. We should be like Moses. That if it comes down to choosing the powers that be or suffering with the people of God, that we would say, you know what? Suffering with the people of God is better. And it's better than all the wealth of Egypt. It's better than all the wealth of America. It's better than all the riches of the world. It's better to be with the people of God. The writer had in his day, if we read in Hebrews 10, we see that in verse 25, there were people who were neglecting to meet with the people of God. There were people who were already tempted to shrink back, to say, I don't know the cost that this may mean for me. Well, friends, I just want us to have in mind the long-term grand picture. That's what the writer wants for him. He wants you to know that Moses thought in terms of not years, decades. He thought in terms of centuries and millennia. The question that we need to ask ourselves is, are we living life in such a way that in 10,000 years we will not have regretted what we did? We're not talking about just what we're doing today or what we're doing next week in a small scale of things. The Bible story was long in its telling before us, and if Christ tarries, it will be long in its telling after us. We need to think about in terms of the big picture. And we need to know that it's better to suffer with the people of God if that's what it would mean to obey Him. Better to suffer because there is a reward, and one day there will be no more mourning or death or pain.